you do have a Bible, turn to Philippians 3:18, and we're going to be reading Philippians 3:18 through 21. And we're going to be continuing our series on food that we started before some of the Easter stuff. So we're going to talk about how to glorify God with your food this week and next week, and then we'll be on to something else, Lord willing. But we're really not going to be in one passage today. We're going to do a little bit of a topical discussion as it relates to glorifying God with food. So we're going to be all over the place, but we'll just start by reading Philippians 3:18 through 21. Philippians 3:18. For many, of whom I have often told you and now tell you, even with tears, walk as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction, their God is their belly, and they glory in their shame, with mind set on earthly things. But our citizenship is in heaven, and from it we await a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body by the power that enables him to be subject to all things to himself. Now, when you talk about a subject like food, there really is very few topics that the church has avoided more probably than this one. I plan on saying a variety of very obvious things related to this subject today. So today is going to be a little bit of an exercise in saying the obvious. But then when you live in a bit of an insane society, one of the things that happens is that when you say the obvious, many people seem to be very scandalized by that thought and will often go on attack. And so it's one of those strange phenomenons to witness when you talk about this kind of subject. The conclusions that people generally jump to when you say things that are fairly straightforward and fairly obvious. Now, when you talk about food in general, there's probably very few people in the room today who I imagine experience no guilt as it relates to like the subject of food in general. So when you think about eating food, I'm sure that the vast majority of people have it. Particularly women, and this is a topic that we're going to talk about today, and there's reasons why that's the case, but you know, most of the problems that we're going to discuss related to food guilt and ways in which we abuse food characterize women more than men. There's some that are obviously more related to men, but a lot of them are more related to women, and there's reasons why this is the case. But when you talk about this subject in general, what I'm trying to say is that a vast majority of people experience some kind of guilt. There's a sense in which we all love to eat, and then there's probably a sense in which we all feel at least some sort of shame. Now, guys are guys often excel at suppressing feelings of guilt and shame much more than women, and so they don't always feel the same sort of guilt as it relates to food as women do, but we'll discuss some of those things. But food guilt is a real thing that we all experience. From 2000 to about 2018, obesity prevalence in the United States increased from about 30%, 30.5%, all the way up to about 42.4%. So, you know, obesity prevalence is on the rise. There's a lot of, you know, conditions that are related to obesity that are fairly significant. So if you want to think about some of the major causes of death in the United States, it really isn't COVID. That was somewhat of a delusion that the higher-ups used to control us. But if you want to think about the actual causes of death in our country, the significant actual causes of death, one of the things that you'll find is that most of the major leading causes of what could be described as preventable or premature death. Now I'm going to use preventable and premature are premature, I'm going to put that in scare quotes because there's a sense in which God is sovereign and there is no such thing as a premature death, although God does use means to accomplish his ends. But among, you know, many of the leading causes of what you might describe as premature death include heart disease and stroke, certain forms of cancer. Type 2 diabetes can come from conditions related to obesity. You know, a lot of the problems with male-female intimacy in the context of marriage are related to obesity. For obvious reasons, there are problems related to that, and so there's a lot of difficulties that come from obesity in general that are related to health, that are related to intimacy, that are just related to quality of life. You know, if you're If you're a person who basically has let themselves go a little bit physically, it is very difficult to enjoy playing with your kids, to enjoy getting up off the couch, enjoy moving, enjoying doing things. If you want to have good quality of life, there are obvious ways to get that, and there's obvious ways to try to put a damper on that kind of thing in general. But then the point here is just to say that America, in general, we obviously have problems related to the subject of food, and we don't really know what to do with this subject. And you know what? It's very difficult to even talk about this subject. And the moment that you talk about this subject, a strange kind of phenomenon happens, okay? And you ought to be aware of it, and you ought to be aware of where it's coming from. So a person can't say just obvious things related to this topic without instantaneously appearing like that 95-pound girl who's telling the 100-pound girl that she needs to lose a little bit of weight. And so immediately, if you start talking about this topic, you're put in that kind of category. And, you know, I do want to tell you today that I'm neither a girl nor 95 pounds. So, you know, it's unwise to go there with it. And it might be that if you're tempted to go there with it, you're projecting upon a speaker certain things that are not happening, that maybe are more related to guilt in your own heart than are related to what's actually being communicated here. Now, when I grew up being, you know, what has come to be described as anorexic. Now, anorexic is one of those horrible words that I'm going to talk about a little bit today, because it's a word that makes you think that a person who refuses to eat food is suffering from some sort of mental illness or some sort of mental problem, and that's the furthest thing that could be from the truth as far as that's concerned. But when I was growing up, when I was in college, the anorexic thing became the anorexic movement became a pretty significant thing. To the point where a lot of your, you know, famous actresses were becoming skeletal thin. I didn't really keep up with it a whole lot, but I mean, I'm aware of one of those Olsen twins, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, became significantly anorexic. I can't remember which one it was. An actress named Calista Flockhart. I can't even remember what she played in, but she became significantly anorexic. As far as that is concerned, I had a female relative of mine that was in my extended family who got caught up in that. She was so proud of the fact that her spine was jutting out from her skin, and so she showed me, you know, the stegosaurus-like pattern on her back as a badge of honor. And I thought, what in the world is going on that we think that this is attractive or good at this point? But so when I was growing up, that was that movement was in, you know, full bloom. And I remember going to school in California, and you know, a lot of the girls in California, they didn't eat quite as much as the girls in Alabama did. And so there was pressure upon them from Hollywood as far as that's concerned. But it was one of those interesting things to watch, like in terms of social phenomenons, to watch yourself in chapel, you know, on a weekly basis. And it was almost on a weekly basis that some, you know, girl who wasn't eating as much as she should would pass out and fall over. And it happened so often to the point where, you know, everyone just kept on singing like normal, and it's just like people came and rushed her off and took care of her. And I mean, I'm not saying it's the same one. It was just different ones that would just drop, you know. And so that was happening when I was growing up. And then what's happened now is that we've transitioned from like skeletal thin being, you know, the pinnacle of beauty, to now it's all about body positivity. And, you know, body positivity, you would think, well, hey, that's kind of an improvement, right? I mean, it's kind of an improvement to that you're not like encouraging women in particular. And we're not just going to talk about women today, I assure you, but you would think, hey, that's an improvement that, you know, women don't have to feel so much pressure related to their physical appearance that they're starving themselves to death and are passing out and everything else, to now it's, you know, there's a movement basically that has developed in society to where, you know, we want to praise women of all shapes and sizes, essentially. And then now we're not celebrating like the skeletal thin thing anymore, but then you can go into Target and essentially see, you know, 400-pound women on the in the clothing aisles, being put forward, doing model poses as examples of health. And I mean, there's no shortage of internet comments that you're going to see that basically are saying that, you know, being 400 pounds is healthy and fine and normal and brave. Not only that, but brave and courageous, right? And so, like, being, it's courageous and brave and triumphant and, you know, slay queen and all that, right? And so, something strange is happening then when you put like obesity forth as an example of health. So there was something strange that happened before where being skeletal thin was put forward as an example of health and something to model yourself after. And now we've kind of gone to the extreme opposite end of the spectrum to where, you know, morbid obesity is being praised as a virtue. And, you know, when Adele, like for many years, Adele, the singer, was like an inspiration to all, you know, all the obese women in the world, essentially. And then when she decided that she was killing herself and she needed to lose a little bit of weight, then her fans basically looked at her and said, "How dare you, you know, shame us in this way?" And now, you know, going on a diet is considered fat shaming yourself, and it's the worst thing that you can possibly do. But here's the point. So the point here is just to say that we're living in a world right now that doesn't really know at all what to do with food. It doesn't know how to glorify God with food. We're, you know, like a ping pong ball going back and forth with different extremes, and we don't know how to navigate these kind of issues. We don't know how to walk through these issues. And the point, though, is that we're just really not allowed to talk about these kind of issues. And this is why you probably never heard any pastor ever talk about these things before, is because this subject is really just totally off limits. It's off limits, you know, in terms of the pulpit, but it's off limits in terms of counseling. If you think about, you know, pastors having the audacity and the gall to think that they could possibly help, you know, individuals who are, you know, suffering from anorexia or bulimia. You think that, you know, some criminal malpractice is happening there, just to think that we can give individuals the Bible and help them to understand how to glorify God with the food that He has given us to enjoy. And so we're going to talk about some of these things today, and we're going to talk about a variety of principles. I have six today to talk about that are related to how to glorify God with our food. And next week we're going to talk about the same topic, how to glorify God with our food, but we're going to do so related to topics of food purity and hospitality and everything else. And so if this week is offensive, just wait till next. It gets worse, you know. It gets worse. But today we're going to talk about how to glorify God with our food. And, you know, I do hope that we take some of these things to heart and that we can provide some sort of clarity about how to navigate some of these discussions. But the first principle, and as I said, we're going to talk about how to, you know, today is going to be largely an exercise in stating the obvious. But the first principle that we'll talk about today as it relates to glorifying God with our food is the principle of actually eating our food, okay? So actually eating food. The Bible says in Matthew 6:11, "Give us this day our daily bread." So Matthew 6:11 assumes, so Jesus, you know, in the Lord's Prayer, we're supposed to pray, "Lord, give us this day our daily bread." And that assumes that bread is something that should be, at the very least, or food at the very least, is something that should be a daily thing that we participate in. And this is something we talked about a couple weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago at this point, is that human beings, unlike the rest of God's creation, there's many different animals that God's made, and humans aren't an animal, but I'm saying like the rest of God's creation, there's many animals that can go many, many years without eating, but, you know, human beings, we spend a significant portion of our time eating. Before the days of fast food, and before the days of, you know, microwavable meals, quick meals you can put in the oven, you know, it used to be that a significant portion of an individual's day, particularly a wife or a homemaker's day, might be spent making food. Because we are creatures who typically like to eat at least probably 3 times a day, and some people eat a little bit less than that, and some people like to eat a little bit more than that, but 3 seems to be the normal way that most of society seems to function, with 3 meals. And the Bible seems to reinforce this notion in that we are individuals who seem to be dependent upon food in order to get up and do things. And so if you're an individual who refuses to eat, One of the things that you'll notice is that you're not going to have a lot of energy. There's been times in my life where I've been on significantly low-calorie diets, and when you go on a pretty low-calorie diet, one of the things that happens is that you don't want to get up out of the bed and move because God's given you food. And if you don't have any carbs, you know, carbs are there for quick energy. One of the things that happens is you don't have a whole lot of energy. And if you really want to accomplish a lot of the purposes that God have for you, a lot of those purposes do involve movement. Now, I know that we're living in an increasingly sedentary society, and some of those things might be a bit different in different societies. But point here is just to say that how do you glorify God with food? Well, you have to actually eat food. That's the point. Because God has made you to be a creature who is dependent on food. And apart from food, you're not going to have the strength or the energy needed to accomplish the purposes that God actually have for you. Now, we've obviously worded it in this way, actually eat food, in order to talk about the subject of what has become known as anorexia. Now, the problem with all these psychological labels like anorexia is that when you use these labels, and I don't know a better way to talk about this subject other than to just talk about the word that you guys are all aware of, and that's this word of anorexia. But then the problem with using the labels in of itself, as I've already said, is that it makes you think that the individual who is refusing to eat or refusing to actually eat their food is some sort of victim of some sort of mental problem that they have. And so if you use these terms, like what we're trained to do is we're trained to think of these terms as quasi-medical terms. And so if you think about an individual who has anorexia or is suffering from anorexia, instantaneously you hear that and you're trained to have sympathies that go along those lines to think that that person is suffering from some sort of illness, like they might be suffering from cancer. So you say, so we talk about like this idea of like intentionally starving yourself, for which could happen for a variety of reasons. You talk about that in the language of victimization, and then all of your sympathies go out towards this person. You think this person is essentially suffering from some sort of problem, like they're probably suffering from cancer. And so the person who's refusing to eat, you don't look at them as a moral being who is created in the image of God, who is violating certain principles that are found in God's word, which God calls that individual to. Instantaneously, what you do is you think they're suffering from some sort of problem that makes them a victim, and then your expectations for them are diminished, and then you don't hold them to certain moral standards, and your sympathies go out towards them in the way that they might go if they were suffering from some sort of illness. But then the problem is that just when you think about this idea of like intentionally starving yourself, that is a moral action that an individual is making, that they are morally responsible to make, that they could be making for a variety of reasons, but then the fact is that they're making this moral action, and they're making it of their own volition. And I mean, there could be some sort of scenario that could happen where an individual was, you know, literally being chained to a chair and not fed or something like that, but then you wouldn't call that anorexia at that point. And so whatever anorexia is, it is a moral choice that individuals are making, that they're willfully making, and it's an act of fundamental rebellion against God, and it's an act of defiance to his purposes, and it's a rejection of his actual plan for them and their life. Now, this obviously, and I'm not going to be able to say everything there is to say about this subject, and I'm not going to be able to say very much about this subject in general because we have, you know, five other points to talk about today, but it's obvious that, you know, individuals can fall into this pattern of behavior for a variety of reasons. The problem here related to this is that if you're not thinking of this, an individual who falls into this kind of problem as a victim in terms of them having some sort of medical illness, you know, obviously, like our sympathies go out for an individual in this kind of situation for other reasons. In particular, what I mean is that related to the body positive movement, there is a lot of pressure, particularly on women in our society, to basically live up to a standard of beauty that's put forward as a model, like in terms of just you think about what's put out there as Hollywood, what you see on movie, what you see on television. And so anorexia typically, or, you know, intentional starvation is something that typically women fall more prey to. But then one of the things that we have to think about is we have to ask ourselves, well, why do women fall into this pattern of sin much more than men do? So there's not, you know, there's not a whole lot of men who fall into this pattern of sin where they're intentionally starving themselves. Now, that's going on the rise, like when you're living in a society that basically is blurring gender lines and trying to make men into women and make women into men. These things are on the rise in men, but still it's just way out of proportion. This is predominantly like the temptation to not eat food at all and to starve yourself. That's much more a problem related to women. But then there's a reason why that's the case, okay? So it's not just some arbitrary thing. Now, if you think about this the way our society thinks about this, you may think, okay, well, the Bible has given male-female roles. And what that, like, you may be the kind of individual who thinks, okay, there's male-female roles in the home and in the church. God has designed men to be leaders, and God has designed women to be followers. And that's basically fundamentally the extent of the differences between male and female. But then if you think about the extent of the differences between male and female in just that way, that's remarkably short-sighted. So men and women are fundamentally different kinds of creations of God, and the differences are much more pronounced than all that. And this is why, for the vast majority of women, and just, you know, think about the vast majority of little girls and think about the vast majority of little boys, and the vast majority of little girls want to be pretty, don't they? And the vast majority of little boys want to be strong, okay? So God's designed the world in such a way that the vast majority of women desire to be pretty. And I have five kids, four boys, and I could think of a few circumstances and situations where one of my little boys might have cried because we didn't let them wear an outfit that they wanted to wear. But the only time that that really ever happened was when they wanted to wear a superhero outfit into public or something like that, okay? Into a public place, and then they're just being stubborn and but that doesn't have anything, you have to understand, that has nothing to do with like body image at that point, and that has nothing to do with appearance at that point. But then my daughter, like, she will cry if, like, it's weird. Like, no one taught her to do this, okay? But she will cry if you don't do her hair the way she wants it to be done, and she will change her outfit multiple times a day. And, like, she wants to be pretty. Like, that's the way it works. Like, girls want to be pretty, and men want to be strong. But then the point there is just to say that God's designed the world in such a way that men want, like, men are made in such a way that they're obviously visual, and then they're made to desire the beauty of a woman, and this is the way that God's designed it. And, you know, the Bible actually even says this, 1 Corinthians 11:7, a man ought not to cover his head since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. So woman is made, you know, from man, for man, to be glory to a man. And if you want to read the Bible and you think about the attributes that are used to describe women in the Bible, one of the things you're going to find is that over and over and over again, as you read the Bible, women are described as being beautiful. And over and over and over in the Bible, men are described as being strong. And the reverse of that is not true, okay? That's not just not the way it works. But then because women are designed uniquely to be beautiful, to be fair sex, that this is part of the plan. Women typically struggle with food idolatry, if you want to put it that way, much more than women do. But then the problem is that you're living in a society which basically doesn't understand that fundamental distinction. We think that gender is essentially a social construct. Because we think that gender is essentially a social construct, if a woman is weighed down with guilt and shame and has body image issues, what we do is we instantaneously think, well, that's society putting upon you some sort of standard that is unreasonable. And that is, like, you know, you don't exist. Like, if you want to look up body positive quotes, okay, they're all from women. But what's going to happen is, like, all these body positive quotes, you can do it, you could do it now if you want to, just look up body positive quotes, you'll see what I'm saying. It's all just, like, women talking to women. But the problem with all these quotes is that they're basically trying to undermine this basic brute reality that God made women to be beautiful. And so, and made them not only to be beautiful, but to be beautiful for a specific man who is going to marry them and going to enjoy their beauty in the context of marriage forever. And so that very proposition proposition in of itself is problematized, and because that proposition is problematized, then what happens is that you see a woman who basically is refusing to eat because she has a distorted view of what beauty looks like, and she has pursued vanity in certain sense. Or, you know, it might be that some means she has of controlling her life in a situation that's tough, and there could be a variety of other causes. But the point here is just to say that you're looking at a person who is not eating and abusing their body and abusing God's purposes of food, and then instantaneously you view them through the lens of a victim, and you're basically saying that society putting upon you certain expectations that you should be attractive, and you need to let go of that. You're not here in order to be attractive to anyone else. All that matters is how you feel about yourself and all that. And I would say that in that way, it might be that the cure is worse than the problem. And the problem is that, you know, God has designed women to be beautiful. But then God, like, the solution to anorexia is not just to tell women that it doesn't matter how you look and you shouldn't care at all about how you look. And none of it matters, and it doesn't matter. Like, all that matters is, you know, how you feel about yourself. Like, that's not actually the solution. And the reason why that's not actually the solution is because that's not actually what the Bible says, and that doesn't actually work, okay? And that's why you can tell yourself that over and over again. You can read all the body positive quotes you want over and over again. You can go through the list, and you can try to self-identify with them, but they'll never work, and they're not going to take away the food guilt, because there is part of God's purpose in the world that a woman is made for beauty. And so you can't just take away that purpose and think that you fixed the fundamental problem. What you have to do is you have to learn how to understand that purpose and put it in the right proportion. And what the Bible does is the Bible doesn't just remove that purpose that God has made women to be beautiful. What the Bible does is it relativizes the importance of that point. And it basically tells women that if you want to be, you know, truly beautiful, what you're going to do is you're not just going to just, you know, let yourself go and not care anymore and just, you know, enjoy food with everything that you have without any breaks or constraint. True beauty is not just going to be found in just, you know, giving over all restraint. What's going to happen is true beauty is found in putting upon godly character and a realization that charm is deceitful and beauty is fading, but a woman who fears the Lord will be praised. And so what the Bible gives us is the Bible gives us an objective understanding of beautiful. It's not just a beauty. It's not subjective, but it's something that's there for a time, to be enjoyed for a time, but it's not the ultimate end-all, be-all of life. And it's something that ultimately is going to fade in life, and the maturity is going to be found in not just giving yourself over to sloth and worthlessness, or not just trying to starve yourself to death. True beauty is going to be found in making responsible choices and living, like, not just to the, you know, glory of food or the glory of your outward appearance, but the glory of God. And that's going to give you the things which really make for a good relationship, much more than just simply the physical. So the first point here is just to say, how do you glorify God with food? Well, we're going to actually eat food, okay? And there's plenty more to say about that, but we won't be able to say all that today. Second point here is just to say to eat food with enjoyment. And so in some sense, this is the reverse of the actually eat food portion here, but then it's something that bears in mind. So we're to eat food with enjoyment. 1 Timothy 6, 17 says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but upon God who provides us with everything to enjoy. Now, part of the problem with, you know, many of your fad diets today is that they basically heap upon individuals shame over certain categories of food. And so certain categories of food are said to be off limits. And then, you know, typically it's those categories of food that give you energy as far as that's concerned. But then part of the way that God has actually designed the world is he's designed the world in such a way that food is meant to be something that provides us with enjoyment. And it's kind of interesting to think about the fact that food is a source of enjoyment, because it doesn't necessarily have to be the case that that would be true. I mean, you can conceive of a world in such a way that all the food that God would make would be bland and boring and uninteresting and, you know, hard to stomach and hard to swallow, but that doesn't seem to be the world that he actually made. In fact, it seems to be that he's made food to be made a wide variety of food to be given to us, and the food that he's given to us really is a significant source of enjoyment. And if you, you know, the problem as it relates to this food as a source of enjoyment is kind of an obvious problem. It seems like all the food that tastes good is probably not the best for you, right? And all the food that, you know, is, you know, better for you seems to not be as enjoyable as the opposite is the case. And it's a curious thing to think about, the fact that God seems to design the world in such a way that the things that taste the best seem to be the most harmful to keeping yourself in reasonable proportion. And then the things that that will accomplish that purpose ultimately don't taste as good as some of the other things. Now, I mean, there is some hope here to say that the more that you actually train yourself to make a little bit better choices as it relates to food, the more that, you know, it's obviously true that you can train your palate to respond in different ways. But the point here is just to say that God's obviously given us food as a source of enjoyment. And it's not just a source of enjoyment in this life. It's going to be a source of enjoyment in the next life as well. So if you think about what's going to happen in heaven, you know, in heaven there will be banquets that are filled with food. So food is not just a phenomenon that's particular to this age. Food will be present in the afterlife, and then we can all look forward to the day when we get to, you know, heaven, Lord willing, if we repent of our sins and believe the good news and never have to think about these things again, right? So eat anything that you want to eat without any consequences, that'll be great. And then you'll be able to have perfect self-control and everything else. But the point here is just to say that food is given as a source of enjoyment for us. And you know that you have a fairly unhealthy perspective of food when food for you becomes food is not a source of enjoyment at all. It's just filled with guilt, and it's filled with shame, and it's filled with condemnation. And so there has to be some way that you can actually eat food and enjoy food without food becoming your master on the one hand, or without, you know, food becoming just this miserable experience that's related to just shame and guilt and condemnation. And so as a Christian, it's not enough just to actually eat food if you want to glorify God with food. You have to figure out not only how to actually eat food, so reject, you know, the intentional starving of yourself, but actually learn to eat food with enjoyment. And so now, one of the things you're going to find is as we go through this list, you need all of them. You can't just fixate on one or the other. But what you need is if you're going to try to think through how to glorify God, you're going to need all these points. And so the first one is going to be actually eat food, and then learn to enjoy the food you eat and make it okay that enjoyment is actually part of that. Third point is going to be to don't throw up the food you eat. One of the things that you'll find, and let me see if I can give you a reference here, Acts 27:34. Paul and the crew that he was on was shipwrecked, and they were basically not eating for a few days because they had to make the food last for a while, and they didn't know that they had any hope of rescue. And Paul basically receives like a vision that tells them that rescue is coming, and so they're encouraged to take up some food and eat. The verse says, therefore, I urge you to take up some food, for it'll give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any one of you. Now, like the idea of bulimia, this is another one of those medical, quasi-medical terms that we use in order to describe the phenomenon of an individual basically eating a lot of food and then feeling guilty about it and shame about it, and then throwing up the food they eat. We use this term bulimia, and then the problem, though, is that when I say, you know, don't throw up the food you eat, instantaneously what people think is, man, that's a really mean way to put it. Like, don't throw up the food that you eat. Like, that seems pretty harsh, and that seems pretty unloving, and that seems pretty kind of rude a little bit to put it that way. But then the problem is that, like with the first problem, don't throw up the food that you eat. Like if you're thinking about this as a behavior that an individual chooses because they're rejecting God's design for food, which is to give us strength and to be a source of enjoyment, and they've turned it into a source of shame and a source of condemnation, And what they want is they want all the blessings that come from actually eating food, meaning the enjoyment that come from eating the food, but then none of the consequences from it. And so what you find is in that way, if you just basically describe an action that an individual needs to take, don't throw up the food you eat, don't abuse food in that way, what you're doing is you're dishonoring your body, you're dishonoring the food that God's given you to eat, then instantaneously it sounds as if you're being harsh and it's being unloving. But what you're doing is you're just simply talking about this subject in moral language. Without going into all the general strategies that an individual might use in order to help a person who is actually abusing food in this way, one of the things we have to do is we have to restore the reality that we are talking about a basic behavioral problem that is related to idols that a person has in their own heart. And I'm not gonna give you some comprehensive list of all the idols that a person might be experiencing who binges and purges, but I mean, I can tell you a story about a girl that I counseled once who had given herself over to this vice, if you want to put it that way. And, you know, the way that she was actually helped wasn't to treat her as if she was a victim of her circumstances, but to treat her as if she was a responsible agent. But then with this particular girl, the idols in a person's heart can manifest themselves in a different way. But this girl, basically, she was a girl, and I'll just tell you a little bit about her, but she was a girl who had sisters who were all basically had boyish kind of shapes. So they were all pixie thin kind of girls who basically kind of straight, you know, in terms of the way that they were made. And one of the things that happened to her is she was a girl who had basically more of a, just to put it crassly, a womanly figure. And so once what had happened with her is as she transitioned out of, you know, transitioned into puberty, essentially, what her shape started changing. And the problem is that she started comparing herself to all of her sisters, essentially. And then all of her sisters basically had a different body type than her. There's no other way to put it. And so she looked at the body type that she had been given as a source of shame and a source of condemnation, essentially, and it was something that she had identified in her mind that the standard, like the only standard of beauty that there was to be found, was to be the pixie thin girl like her sisters, and not realizing that she just, you know, had a different shape than them. But then that basically led her on this quest to exercise extreme control over how she ate. And so every time she ate, essentially, and she would feel the slightest stirrings of, as you eat, your stomach starts to expand, and that expanding that happens after you eat a meal, and everyone knows what you're talking about. She identified that with basically being a bodily mechanism that was telling her that she's fat and she's never going to end up in her ideal scenario of what she had identified as pure beauty, which was her stick-thin sisters. And so at that point, you know, she would engage, she would throw up her food. And then the more that she would throw up her food, the more that then she gets more guilt and more shame and more condemnation. And that would cause her to eat more, right? So then she would eat more. And then she, more she eats, more she throws up. And she's caught in some sort of cycle, a downward spiral as far as that goes. And so, you know, without getting into how, like, these things can come about, that's just one example of how these things can come about. But the point here is just to say that God didn't give us food in order for us to enjoy it and then feel this guilt and shame and condemnation and then purge ourselves from it. The point here is just to say that God's given us food to actually eat. He's given us food to enjoy, but then he's not given us food to just enjoy, 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 and then, you know, throw it up and lose all the actual primary benefit that food actually is given to us to perform. So the primary benefit that God has for us in the eating of food in of itself is to give us strength in order to accomplish the purposes that you have, that he has for us. And there's a variety of, you know, obviously medical problems that can come if an individual abuses food in any of the ways that we've described. Now, the fourth thing that we'll say as it relates to this topic is that God's given us in order to how we glorify God with food, is we're going to eat food with self-control. Now, There's a variety of verses that we could talk about at this point. Now, some of the verses that we really, I don't know that I've heard a lot of people talk about, like gluttony is related to this idea of self-control. And gluttony is one of those topics that really has gone out of fashion. It's one of those words that's basically disappeared from our vocabulary. We don't really have a category for gluttony anymore. But then the Bible has a lot to say about gluttony. And we need to talk about gluttony and how that relates to a lack of self-control. So Deuteronomy 21:18, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the city of the gate where he lives, and they shall say to the elders of his city, this is our son. He is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. That's kind of one of those interesting passages that, you know, probably most people are scandalized by the fact that there's capital punishment for that. But then notice that is, in that sense, it's related to gluttony and being a drunkard. That's kind of odd. Proverbs 23:20 says, be not among drunkards or among gluttonous eaters of meat. Now, drunkard, like being a drunkard and a gluttonous eater of meat, they're both basically the same sin. Lack of self-control, one's related to intemperance with alcohol, one's related to intemperance with food. But the Proverbs 23:20 says, be not among drunkards or among gluttonous eaters of meat, for the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber will clothe them with rags. That most people spend, like a lot of people spend the majority of their disposable income on food, like on fast food, because they refuse to cook and refuse to go to the grocery store and meal plan and buy meals. And so a lot of people who really struggle financially with their money, if you were to just, ask them, what are you spending your money on? They say, hey, I don't know. I don't know what I'm spending my money on. I don't know where it all goes. Like, there's just nothing there. But then in case after case after case, as you actually talk to them, one of the things that you'll find is that a vast majority of those cases, basically all their disposable income is being spent on eating fast food because they refuse to cook and refuse to meal plan. And so the point here is just to say Proverbs 23:20 says, be not among drunkards or gluttonous eaters of meat, for what? For the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and slumber will clothe them right like rags. And that's obviously true. Proverbs 28:7 says something that's pretty unconscionable to us in our society. The one who keeps the law is a son with understanding, but a companion of gluttons shames his father, right? So what does that tell you? That gluttony should be a source of shame. Gluttony should be a source of shame. Maybe the body positive movement hasn't got it right. Maybe it's a sign of destruction for a society to put gluttons forward as examples of what it means to be healthy. Maybe if you want to destroy a society, you want to destroy marriages, you put gluttons forward as examples of what it means to be pictures of health, and that's basically how you do it. You try to say, hey, there's no shame that comes from being a glutton. The problem is that we all know that there is shame that comes from being a glutton, and we all understand that. We just have to pretend in our society, in order to not lose our jobs, that this isn't the case. So maybe there's some sort of a problem there. Now, as this relates to the topic of weight in general, I just want to say a few words here. Related to this topic. The point with gluttony, and we'll just be very direct, it's not always true that you can just look at a person on the outside and you can say, hey, they're significantly out of proportion or they're significantly overweight, therefore they must be a glutton. So things don't always work in that kind of way. That's not always the case. So we're living in a society right now that seems to excel at making food taste good, but then part of the problem is that we're living in one of the most unhealthy societies as it relates to the diet that we actually eat in the history of the human race, perhaps. And so it is quite possible just to make poor choices about what you're going to eat and then get yourself significantly out of proportion as it relates to the idea of your actual weight in that moment, and it might not say anything about gluttony in general. And part of that is why I think the church really hasn't talked about this subject quite like they should, because it really is, like, it's not as just the case that, everyone who has a few pounds to lose or something like that has a stash of Oreos in their, you know, nightstand drawer that they're sneaking to get, or, you know, in the, you know, their food pantry, they're constantly sneaking in there and eating food, or, you know, that, like, that's not necessarily the case, okay? I mean, it's not necessarily the case that everyone who has, like, a little bit of weight to lose is just sitting on the couch and eating a whole bag full of Doritos, and, you know, that's a nightly thing followed by a tub of ice cream or something. Like, so the point here is just to say that there's, like, you can't, in a simplistic way, like, just look at a person on the outside and say, okay, well, they seem to have no self-control with food. But then part of the problem, though, is that, like, we're living in a society that has such abundance. And so, you know, we're living in a society where, as I said, like, obesity prevalence rates in our society are like 40% now. And part of the thing is that, like, what we've done as a society is we've eaten more and more and more to the point where the meals keep getting bigger and bigger and the drinks keep getting bigger and bigger. And so our standard about what, like, a normal proportion meal has gone on the rise too. And so you can't necessarily trust what's considered normal. So, like, if you live in the 50s and you think about, like, I think it was the 50s. One person in the room can correct me, but no one else later on. you know, the standard size, like, you know, the standard, like, adult meal at McDonald's was like a single cheeseburger with a small fry and a small drink. That used to be like the standard meal for an adult when McDonald's came out. But then now it's like, can you imagine actually being full with that? Like, I can't. Like, that would just be frustrating. To go to McDonald's and eat like a small cheeseburger with a small fry and a small soda. But then what that says is that my stomach has expanded to the point now where what's normal to me is not normal to generations past. And so you can't necessarily trust this. And so, but here's the point though, what the idea about gluttony actually is the idea of gluttony is self-control and moderation and food. So 1 Corinthians 6:12 says, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything. And there's a, you know, variety of ways that we can be gluttons as it relates to food, just related to the issue of self-control. I mean, most people wake up and, you know, I think to my shame, like, for the vast majority of my life, I was addicted to caffeine. Well, that's a form of gluttony. If you can't just get up in the morning and without having caffeine in order to feel okay and function, like, you have a problem, okay? So whether that's like coffee or soda or whatever else, gluttony is a real issue. You know, the more that you eat like sugar, the more that you need to eat sugar. So, you know, there are things in food. I'm persuaded that most fast food restaurants have addictive substances in food, and that's why we can't seem to stop eating so much of it. But 1 Corinthians 6:12 says, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but I'm not be dominated by anything, food included. Proverbs 23:1, when you sit down to eat with a ruler, it says, observe carefully what is before you and put a knife to your throat. If you're given to appetite, do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Proverbs 23:20, we've said this, be not among drunkards or gluttonous eaters of meat, for the drunkard will come to poverty. Slumber will clothe them like a rag. So the idea of, you know, how do you glorify God with food is you're going to actually have to eat food, right? Actually eat food and then eat food with enjoyment. Don't throw up the food you eat, but then actually have to have self-control and moderation as it relates to these things. And you know, and it is probably true that the more that you let, like, it's difficult to know when an individual has crossed the line into gluttony. But then God's obviously designed us to be, you know, certain proportion. The more out of proportion you let yourself be, it probably is a sign of a lack of gluttony, or it probably is a sign of gluttony, but it might not be. You know, it might not be because you're living in a society that has such poor food choices. I mean, just think about how much sugar is actually in a cup of Coke, and you'll realize that some of the things we eat are pretty awful for us as far as that is concerned. So eat food with self-control. Number five, eat food with wisdom. So this is what's interesting. When you read through Proverbs, one of the things you're going to find is that as you read through the Proverbs, often you're going to find that you're going to have a statement. So Proverbs are not laws, they're statements of general truth. And when you read through the Proverbs, one of the things you'll find is that with a variety of topics, you're going to have a positive related to that topic, And then what follows from that is you're going to have a negative related to that topic, and then you're going to wonder, like, how do you fit those two things together? Like, isn't this some sort of contradiction? And it's like, no, there's just qualifications that are given. So Proverbs 24:13 says, "My son, eat honey, for it is good, and the drippings of honeycomb are sweet to your taste." So sugar is good, right? Sugar's good. Honey's good. I don't know that I've really eaten honey like that very much, but maybe I should just be biblical, apparently. But my son, eat honey, for it is good. The drippings of honeycomb are sweet to your taste. Now, related to the principles we already talked about, this is the principle of enjoyment. God's given us all things richly to enjoy. Sugar is one of those things God's given us richly to enjoy. The problem is, Proverbs 25:27, it's not good to eat much honey, right? So, which is it? My son, eat honey, for it's good. Or is it Proverbs 25:27, it's not good to eat much honey, nor it's glorious to seek one's own. All right, so here's the thing. So, like, it's not good to eat much honey, but it is good to eat some honey. And so part of, like, the problem in life is that there's not just simply, as it relates to food and glorifying God with food, it's not just the case that, you know, enjoyment is the only principle that's at operation, right? There's a variety of other principles. So, you know, there's a variety of other principles that are going to be at work as it relates to food. So, you know, it is very much the case that there's a lot of food that does taste good, but if that becomes, like, if you eat that out of proportion, you might want to have a place for it, but if you eat it out of proportion, there are going to be consequences to that, like obesity, like heart disease, like type 2 diabetes, like, you know, strokes, like inability to get up and to play with your kids. You know, there's consequences that come from just eating too much honey. And, you know, this is obviously the case. And so, you know, like, just think about the way that the world actually works and how much sugar is actually in some of the things that we're eating. One of the things you're going to find is it okay to eat ice cream? Sure, it's okay to eat ice cream. Is it good to probably eat like a whole, you know, gallon of ice cream in one sitting? Probably not. Is it good to eat a gallon of ice cream in every sitting, like in one sitting every night? Probably not. Right. So the point there isn't to say that is the ice cream bad? No, the ice cream's fine, but you have to have some sort of wisdom in the proportions that you're eating. And part of the problem is that we're living in a society right now that probably has things way out of proportion as far as, like, the, you know, the idea of what actually makes for a healthy diet is pretty out of whack in terms of some of those things. But then you're going to have some sort of wisdom as it relates to navigating this kind of subject. And so the point there isn't just to say, like, be obsessive about food on the one end to where all you're looking at is your outward appearance and basically, you know, refusing to have any enjoyment with God's creation because you have let yourself go a little bit, gain 5 pounds, gain 10 pounds, whatever it is. No, the point there is just to say God's given us everything richly to enjoy, but you're going to have to use wisdom in thinking about all the available options and trying to come up with a plan. And this is generally why it's better to have a meal plan that individuals are operating under instead of eating fast food every meal. Because if you do have a meal plan, then what you can say about your meal plan is that, like, this is my understanding of what a wise way to eat in the world actually is. And it may not be that your plan is perfect, but you know, if you don't have a plan, here's the problem. You're rejecting all wisdom as it relates to food, right? Like, so here's, like, the point is just to say that, like, coming up with some sort of wise meal plan that you're going to have as a family, and this is something that, you know, husband and wife should be talking through. What are we going to do as a family? What kind of wisdom are we going to use to make sure that we're not using food in such a way as to, you know, basically destroy the body, the temple of God that has been given to us? How are we going to come up with a wise plan that we're going to put forward to say, this is what we're going to do as a family in order to accomplish all the purposes that God actually has for us and be useful to his kingdom and to be available to other people and to not just needlessly suffer from all sorts of preventable illnesses, which we don't have to suffer from, but to actually be clothe ourselves with strength and be useful to God for the kingdom that he has given us and the purposes that he has to establish. And so having some sort of plan to say, okay, like, here's our plan, you know, here's what we're going to eat on a day-to-day basis. here's how, you know, not only is that good for money, meaning like the glutton will come to poverty and slumber will clothe them with rags. It's also good just to be a steward of the body that God's given to you, and you're going to have to use wisdom. And then the final point here is just to say, eat food with thanksgiving. 1 Timothy 4:1, the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times some will depart from the faith, devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and the teaching of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe the truth. For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. So in the last time, there'll be many teachers who will come who will require abstinence from certain kinds of food. We're living in a society, we're going to talk about this next week, that has all sorts of, you know, foods which we've declared to be off limits, elimination diets and everything else. The problem is that there's many people who are trying to fix our fundamental problem of guilt with food, who forbid marriage, require abstinence from certain foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving. So Luke 22:19, Jesus, he took the bread, and after he had given thanks, he broke it and he gave it to them, and he said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And so the reason why we thank God before we eat is not just as something that we do. The reason why we thank God is because, like, we realize that God has certain purposes for food. We talked about a few weeks ago. And those foods purposes involve to strengthen us, to give us energy, to help us to accomplish all the plans that he has for us. God's created us as creatures who are dependent upon food in order to live and to survive. And a lot of these other problems that we've talked about can be fixed with this knowledge of thanksgiving. And so not just having, you know, praying before meal being something that's just some rote thing that you do, something that you check off the box and say, "Hey, we did that. Lord, thanks for the food. The end. Amen." That's fine that you pray that, as long as you mean that. But the point here is just to say that you need to eat food with thanksgiving. And if you eat food with thanksgiving, then that means you're actually going to eat it, right? So thank you for the food that God, you created me as a creature who's designed to eat. So I'm going to eat today, and I'm going to thank you for the food that you've given me, and thank you that this is a means that you've given to me, a provision in order to help me to go on. So I'm gonna, like, the giving thanks actually helps you to eat, because you're thanking God for something that's meant to be a blessing to you. You eat it with enjoyment, meaning, you know, you don't have to feel guilt and shame and condemnation every time you eat your food. God's given you food to enjoy, and you thank him for that gift. And it's very hard to throw up something that you just thank God for, right? So learning to thank God for food will help you to not throw up the food that you ate, because you're bringing a Godward consciousness to what you're actually doing. And then eating food with self-control, like, the act of thanking God for your food is going to remind you that you, your body is a stewardship that's given to you, and he has basically forbidden you from being a glutton and lacking self-control. And so as you thank God for your food, you're reminded that this is a blessing that he's given to you that's meant for your enjoyment, but not something that you're supposed to abuse. It's something that you're supposed to eat with wisdom in terms of how you're even interacting with this subject in general. And so fundamentally, this idea of eating food with thanksgiving is helping to tell us what it means to glorify God with our food. And what it means to glorify God with our food is eat food to God's glory, fundamentally as the overarching goal over all the things that we're doing. And so it's just, I'm eating to the glory of God. I'm enjoying this food to God's glory. I'm not throwing up this food because it's given to God, to me by God, to accomplish it for his glory. And I'm eating it with self-control because I'm living to his glory and not just to my own, you know, gluttony or my own pleasure. Like, my pleasure is not the ultimate end. God's created me for other things. And if I just have no self-control with food, I can't honor God and glorify God with the food that he's given me. And I'm going to use wisdom in order to know, you know, how much honey to eat, so to speak. But then I'm going to eat it with thanksgiving, knowing that, you know, all the food that God has designed is given for us, given to us to glorify him. And it's a good gift that our Creator has given. And it's no doubt it's made more difficult living in a fallen world, but we ought to thank God for what he's done for us and pray that he would help us to be good stewards of the body that he's given us and to eat food to his glory today.
We are so encouraged that you chose to engage with God's Word on our Provenance podcast. For more biblical teaching, resources, media, and to financially support the mission of Provenance, please visit ProvenanceChurch.com. Until next time, go equip one another to embody humanity's one true purpose.